Okay, this is the seventh session, side three, June 3rd, 2006. What were you saying, Scott, about...
I went to this group. They published a book on the subject. They were doing the EVP. I forget what that stands for, but what they do is they use digital and analog recording equipment. They set it up in such a way as to... I don't understand the process of how they set it up, but somehow they get some kind of white noise going on, which allows them to pick up the sounds of voices from the quote-unquote other side. They pick up the voices of ghosts, they pick up the voices of channeled entities, and, you know, so you'll be listening to this white noise, and then all of a sudden you'll hear the recognizable series of phonemes that sound like words that are not just random white noise being detected by the recording equipment. And somebody even did a whole movie on it recently, a dramatization. It was kind of dopey. I forget what it was called.
Is this the E.J. Gold group?
No. Oh. You're not aware of this phenomena?
Yes, I'm aware of it.
Oh, okay.
I remember that's the one where... It came through the Bob's talk show on the end.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So these people suggested that they thought that before too long, we're going to be able to have pretty clear technological development with the astral planes, because they believe that there are entities on the astral planes developing technology to interface with technology that we, communication technology we developed on the physical plane. So if there are actually scientists thinking in terms of how can we develop technology on the astral plane to interface with communication technology on the physical plane, then there really is getting to be an intermingling of technology and soul.
Right, and this is my chart, the mixture, the no separation between the chemical body, astral body, TV body, chip body. And you have the astral body imagery being updated by people bringing in implications of chip body and saying it's being developed on the astral body, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, that's the merger of the four. And the AP, the human essence, whatever the human is, the mystery of the human is in the interval between this. But, you know, to say that, to make a probe and say this may be happening, is not enough for awareness today. You need to be aware of the insolubility of the interface of these different situations. You have to, it seems to me, you have to accept those that don't
believe. What do you mean the insolubility of the interface?
Yeah.
They're all interfaced and merged.
Right. And the insolubility of the descriptions of them, the memes that will try to, the old forms of describing them.
Oh.
You know, because we're in the silence now, right?
Yeah.
And the silence is the gestural violence, or an effect of it. We're in the silence, post-information, we're in the silence. The media yoga position is, when I meet people who don't believe in the other, in any other life, and believe this is all there is, and what are they, the extropians? They're really into developing technology as fast as possible. They freeze themselves. What did Disney do?
Yeah, cryogenic.
Yeah, he freezes his brain, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're hoping to have that relived. I could say, yeah, that may be true. You know, that may be all we are. And I wouldn't start a fight with them. But then it seems that what way I make a living will force me to take a position or to pretend to force a position. So if McLuhan's right, we're going into a right hemisphere environment, we're going to deal with more and more religious fanatics, and the extropians are going to be in the minority. And we're going to have to tell the extropians, yeah, you want all this technology, but it's going to have the... Presently, we're dealing with effects of the technology we have now, which frustrates the implementation of your vision, just like it frustrated the implementation of LaRouche's vision. Would they believe that? Probably not. So we got... People say we're in a war of the mind. And then people then say that's really a war of beliefs. But you have to say the word belief or mind is embedded with these four bodies and not the image. Now we're coming back to what our images are. It's a war of images. What is the image of the mind? my chart gives an image of the mind, and it's a lot of external environments, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's our mind.
Well, mind is thoughts.
Yes, but what's your image of thought? What do you think a thought is? You can't tell. It's a tactile interplay of the inner and the outer. Remember the line McClung quoted? The Eskimo, the primitive says, how do I know tree without the word tree? They know that the word tree or the thought tree is part of knowing tree. But it's not one over the other.
But when we get into ESP, you know, I've heard these descriptions of near-death experiences. Some people, most people, they go towards the light. Now, we don't know what happens after they enter the light. Some people say the light is so hallucinatory, they freak out and jump back into a body. Other people say they pass through the light and go into heaven. Other, you know, we don't know what happens after they go into the light, but they experience moving into the light as being blissful. And then there's a minority of people. Oh, and by the way, with respect to near-death experiences, I heard this recently by an expert in the field, and I thought this was interesting. Only a very small percentage of people who die on the operating table actually, at least, either have a near-death experience or at least remember it. It's a pretty small percent. I think maybe 1 in 10 people. But there's a minority of people who experience going into kind of an underworld state where everyone is telepathic, everyone is in a high state of anxiety and paranoia, everyone's thoughts are crowding into everyone else's head, everyone's both trying to defend and aggressively fight all the other thoughts, and so it's just one big crowded mishmash hell experience of telepathy.
When you're in the astral plane.
When you go into the underworld, into the hell, one of these dimensions in the astral plane where, you know, it doesn't sound very pleasant.
Okay.
Because there's all these strata to the astral plane, you know.
See, look, what is the thought on that plane? Is it a voice and you hear a thought and you can't think your own?
Yeah, it's like you hear everybody's thoughts, and I guess in terms
well,
of
that's
probably,
noisy.
Yeah.
It's not, and so it's not thought. It's just sensory data on another level.
Mm.
See, we thought is, I like the idea of tactility is not a sense,
mm-hmm.
but it's the interplay of sense.
Right.
I also say tactility is thought, because you can't tell the dancer from the dance. We cannot place where consciousness and thought is.
Mm.
You can't place what its images are. The images is the interplay.
Right.
So thought is tactility.
But thought can be electrically measured on these machines that they use to monitor your brain waves.
They can be measured, but they can't measure what it influences.
Mm-hmm.
You can't measure. You measure some electrical registration, vibration, but you can't measure what its range of influence is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where is its leverage, its fulcrum, its impact, its kinetic impact?
Yeah. Well, the Charles Ottsman, nanotechnology scientist, was posed a question, will they be able to plant a chip in your head that meters your thoughts in the same way that a water meter, you know, meters your water or your electricity? And will they be able when you're thinking within certain contexts, will the meter turn on and you'll be paid in micropayments for the thinking that you did on that particular subject?
Right. You need a meter to do that.
Yeah.
To figure out the effect of thought.
Yeah.
And they're probably going to, you see, if electricity is boundless, we don't even know its range of operation. Only when we relate it back to a visual space mechanism do we get a sense, but we're not sure. There's your ocean you talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Is the ocean one little electrical charge? So these things are probably not knowable as we're talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was thinking that you're tending in our sessions to cite a lot of Buddhist and astral plane mystical reference points. That's what you're bringing to this.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking a lot in the different tapes about death and the afterlife and what the Evergreens say. There's different ways to talk about this, but it's not the natural way to discuss LaRouche. In other words, you are in the Thompson Quadrant. That's what you naturally have studied for the last 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And you're bringing Thompson Quadrant issues to McLuhan first and then LaRouche. Well, not first, but we've done McLuhan, you brought in Thompson squadrons, Thompson issues, what I call Thompson issues, and you're bringing Thompson issues into the LaRouche situation. So we have to look at LaRouche in his own terms and then juggle it with the others.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can you bring in a Croker aspect to LaRouche? Do you know Croker enough to apply questions that LaRouche seems to be raising about the little me to the way LaRouche...
Well, when I think about Croker, I don't know him well enough. I keep associating him with, like, the French deconstructionists, and
right.
I think there's more to him than that, and so I'm looking forward to getting into Croker so I can understand him a little better.
All right, so basically...
But we do have enough time, I think. Let's go back to LaRouche, since that's what you're indicating, and let's deconstruct.
Let's read this. I'm going to read it, you know, fluently through and see if, like we did the last session, we could see the quote we were dealing with clearer after all that discussion in between.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah, and just look at, he is recommending a strategy of the little me that's different from the normal Christian, humanist, secularist, mystic solution to the little me problem. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let me just see what the previous quote was. Pure emotion. He says, then what is the act corresponding to the pure emotion of love? Is a pure emotion an electrical charge in our brain? And what would be the size of that pure emotion? What is the act? It probably would depend on what the culture accepts as the limits of how love can be expressed.
Mm-hmm.
What is the act corresponding to the pure emotion of love? This is on page 8, the bottom paragraph. What is the act corresponding to the electrical charge of love? So let's pretend that the next paragraph is what he's answering. He's saying the most efficient way in which to identify the distinctions to be made is this. The distinctions in what is love, what is creative, what is the little me, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the most efficient way in which to identify the distinctions to be made is this. In abstraction of ordinary consciousness, the control of mental productions and communications is associated constantly with notions of oneself. So he's saying, when you're thinking, in the abstraction of ordinary consciousness, you have a self in relation to that, vibrating, dancing with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes on, perhaps the individual ordinarily does not reflect on this. No, not too much. And ordinarily is therefore usually unaware of the existence of these executive controls of the one's image of oneself in relation to what you're going to be conscious of, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that could be culturally conditioned, the images you have of yourself in its executive capacity. LaRouche continues, it is not difficult to provoke such awareness, get them sort of meta-conscious of their relationship between their self-controlling their ideas of consciousness. In brackets, he says, indeed, a skillful operator in a therapy group or in any group which can be directed to act as a therapy group can readily force the attention of virtually all participants to such feelings very quickly. Once one has done this several times, the ability to replicate the effect becomes almost automatic. So that's where you're in a little limited environment, like in a laboratory, and you focus through language, probably, and stories and emotional anecdotes that make you deal with your image of yourself without having to run around and go to the bathroom or make a dinner or attend to attacking terrorists. You know what I mean? You're in an isolated situation. And in that isolation, you can intensify the little me dialectic with its own sense of consciousness. Then he says, in ordinary states, the form of these notions of ego ideals, images of oneself, is what one would best describe as feelings about attributes of a monad-like little me. So he's saying, in ordinary states, the form of these notions of ego ideals is what one would best describe as feelings about attributes of a monad-like little me. Sometimes it seems that he's saying too many words to make a simple point, but I think to create the intensity of the therapeutic situation, he makes you really pay attention to what the sentence is saying, right? You've got to get into the rhythm of it. Again, in ordinary states, the form of these notions of ego ideals is what one would best describe as feelings about attributes of a monad-like little me. In other words, the normal notion of ego ideal, not the intensified one in the therapy session, is the little me. In general, the instant one succeeds in cutting through the persona of an individual to force his reflection on these feelings, the usual sensation experienced by the open-up individual is, I am a fraud. Probably because the images one evokes in that intensified situation are not relevant to the images when one's engaged in a normal, practical, pragmatic life, daily activities. And if you isolate and think it's a fraud, it begins to think it's the little me is not in its context. You have to be a little me when you're interacting with other people. It's decorum, it's politeness, and you can't keep overpowering everybody to get the factory moving. You've got to take your little slot. But then if you really intensify that out of context, it appears to be irrelevant. So LaRouche is pointing out how the establishment of the little me as a fraud is, in a way, not a valid way to look at the self. You know what I mean? He's critiquing this technique of therapy group. There is a more or less immediate recognition that the self one presents to the outer world is a synthetic character, a mere persona. I would say it's out of context. It's not in the context where it's useful. A manufactured, for example, artificial product created for the propitiatory edification of the credulous. Well, that may not be true. I mean, it's created for the context it's used in. Like the little me, the literate self, is for a literate industrial society, the assembly line society. But I'm critiquing LaRouche here. Continuing on, LaRouche says, it's created for the propitiatory edification of the credulous. I don't know if it's an element of the credulous, other than the society believes in the industrial environment, and everybody's incredulous before that and believes it. Thus, oneself as presented to the world is not the real me. So it's a fraud, therefore it's oneself as presented to the world is... Thus, oneself as presented to the world is not... He's describing this little me, and in this weakening situation, you begin to think it's not the real me. Thus, oneself as presented to the world is not the real me, not the soul. Very quickly... Now, isn't that interesting? Not the soul. Now, that falls back into the otherworldly Western Christian or religious Buddhist zone, right? Just fall back out of the technological generated little me self, back into the religious soul that came into this world, if you accept that we came into this world from another dimension. Very quickly, the affected individual can begin to discover and detail how I operate. It's like McLuhan's point. You take the fish out of the environment, he can see the environment. Put someone in this therapeutic thing, out of the industrial environment, he can see how he operates. The self becomes visible like an art form, but a fraudulent method. Very quickly, the affected individual can begin to discover and detail how I operate. Accompanying this enlarged awareness, there's usually a growing depression associated with the sense that the real self is a kind of monad, a little me. In other words, you begin to think, you see what you were conditioned by, and you think that's what you are. But you're being fooled by the intensified context that makes you focus on that aspect of your whole being, right?
Mm-hmm.
The fact that such a monad could only be an empty construct forces the individual to regard the criteria by which I operate as necessarily the only existing qualities attributable to the little me. So here's where it seems to me LaRouche is saying you're being duped into not accepting and working with the second nature conditions. You're beginning to see that they're fraudulent. And you start looking around for something else, right? The fact that such a monad could only be an empty construct forces the individual to regard the criteria by which I operate, the context for the little me, as necessarily the only existing qualities attributed to the little me, and therefore it seems weak, fragile, and you become aware of yourself and become depressed. Consequently, and that reminds me, I mean, making someone aware, you got to deal with the responsibilities of the coming down from it. From that heightened awareness.
No. So let me toss out an idea.
Okay, let me just finish this paragraph.
Okay.
Then you remember it. Consequently, these being the same qualities associated with the production of the fraudulent outer self, the persona of the little me is a degraded thing. Okay, I didn't read that right. Consequently, these being the same qualities associated with the production of the fraudulent outer self, the persona of the little me is a degraded thing, intrinsically unlovable. Quote, how could God love my miserable little soul? And he says, at bottom, in this respect, I won't go into that. Okay, what were you going to say?
Maybe another way of saying what I was trying to say before, but...
We lost it?
No. I'm not sure. I think you have a different spin on this than I did when I first read it. When I first read this, my spin on this was, and I'm going to find some new words to say it, because I haven't...
When we read it on the tape?
Yeah. Because my first attempts a half an hour ago to talk about this seemed inadequate, and I'm thinking of a new way to talk about this.
Yeah.
That LaRouche is saying that language creates within our mind a simulacrum.
Yeah.
That we think is who we are. In other words, our persona, our identity, what we identify as being me, the monad-like little me, is really a simulacrum.
Well, it's effective second nature.
And when we find out that it has no substance, because it's a simulacrum has no substance, it has no soul, then we feel like it's a fraudulent I. I'm a fraud. Because in identifying with the simulacrum, we've lost our intrinsic possibility of knowing ourselves as being what I think we talked about earlier when we talked about LaRouche as being the logos or the divine mind.
Okay, in other words, he's implying there's another dimension. He's bringing in the doubleness. He's bringing in the soul. He may not...
I think he's saying there is something that's real about us, but because we've become identified with the simulacrum of who we are, we've lost our true sense of connectedness to that which in us, which is real.
Yeah, well, I know that I'm not sure if this... this is beyond psychoanalysis. He is critiquing in this essay the therapeutic standards of the 20th century. And so I'm taking this, since I read the whole paper, if I remember it right, I may be wrong, he's critiquing the way one heightens the little me and misses, ends up missing the importance of the simulacrum.
Mm-hmm. Right. I was noticing that you and I have a different spin on what he's saying here. I'm very interested in your spin on this.
Yeah, no, we're in the doubleness. I grant that it may be what you're saying, but I'm biased because I have a lot of history reading LaRouche, and I know where this comes from, this quote, you know, the context of it. At least I think I do. But let's see where it leads in the next two finishing paragraphs, because it might clarify it. Because I agree, we don't know which one of us is getting it right here. At bottom, in this respect, the effort to get at the inner self, in quotes, brings us, in the ordinary case, to a little hardball, a monad of sorts, from which apparently emanate the qualities, the feeling states or instincts, etc., which one otherwise encounters in cathexis, in consciousness and semi-consciousness. In cathexis means like in crystallization. So the little hardball, which apparently emanate the qualities, from which emanate these qualities, which one otherwise encounters in general solidity, in consciousness and semi-consciousness, because you're not confronting it all the time. Ostensibly, any effort to probe the self more deeply, to get within the monad, results in locating only an it or an id. In fact, precisely such results can actually be obtained. From his other writings, I think he critiques the Freudian emphasis on id as the ground. He's critiquing the effects of this intense therapy, because it starts to emphasize the id and not the creative mentation process. So the next paragraph, he says, when the same self-analysis is affected in the case of individuals in the state of self-conscious creative production, the phenomena of the monad are not obtained. You see, he's kind of not, he's against the monad's effect.
Mm-hmm.
The ego ideal and the notion of inner self are instead united in a single quality. Examined more superficially, one could obtain the apparent result emphasized by Kubi. At first inspection, the idea of creative activity for its own sake is the ego ideal. That's on the first inspection. A form whose content is the activity of necrotropic synthesis itself. Accordingly, if one studied artistic and other personalities who are merely creative or only yet potentially self-conscious, one would tend to concur with Kubi's argument that the creative process must be regarded as a virtue in itself. Now, we kind of leave it hanging there, but I think the next quotes, which we'll get into later, further develop what he's trying to get to. He's saying that there is... Would you agree that he's saying, in the previous paragraph, not the one I just read, ostensibly any effort to probe the self more deeply to get within the monad results in locating only an id, or an it, an id. In fact, precisely such results can actually be obtained. And so he's saying that that process leads to tapping into the monad. But then he's sort of offering something that's...
So you're equating the monad to the id?
Or the id is the foundation of it.
And the id, give me your idea of what the id is.
Well, there's the Freudian idea, there's different ideas, but I think he's saying that the id is sensuous limitations.
Yeah, I think it's closely associated with the word instincts, which he uses.
And feeling states. He's saying that that Kubi's process points to another way of realizing a different kind of monad, or not the monad that is anchored in the id.
Tell me what you think Gestalt therapy is.
Well, I don't know.
As per Kubi.
Well, it was a clinical psychoanalysis, way back 80 years ago. I don't know the particulars. I have to go look it up and read him.
Mm-hmm.
But he was... Those guys trained in the Kubi method were not impressed with the way Pearls took it. But Pearls was popular because he responded to from a Kuhn's point of view, a new technological environment where the Kubi method wasn't relevant. The psyche that it was relevant for was not being developed in the TV era.
When I think of Gestalt, I think of getting the person to relate
to the
part,
id.
Part to the id,
yeah,
in such a way as to combine parts within oneself that one hadn't combined before to create a synergy, to create something new.
Okay, hold that. And I think that's what I'm remembering now, is that he is critiquing the therapy group, showing what it can do, but it is not the way to develop a healthy, active person. And he's going back to the original Gestalt guy, Kubi, and saying he had the right track of how to either counter the monad or develop a monad not based on the id. Okay? So with that in mind,
we're saying that Gestalt is not working with the id.
Right. The real Gestalt, the earlier therapy, was more relevant because that is against the therapy groups that get bogged down in the id.
Because the id is where you've got the shadow, as Jung would put it, violent, primal impulses. That's animal nature, and LaRouche wants to evolve beyond that.
Yeah, he considers that childish behavior. Going back to the child, the infant who's totally dependent on sensory satisfaction.
Yeah.
Okay.
But people feel many times if they have garden variety neurosis, they have feeling states that are a problem. They're troublesome.
Right.
And if they could get into those feeling states and do primal scream or something, that somehow they would process that or bring it to consciousness, and they would work through it, and they would be free of those limitations of id feeling states. But never going to get rid of your id feeling states. I don't know if they can be transmuted or what LaRouche is thinking, if that should be, it should not be a focus of conscious attention. You should be focusing your attention on.
Right. And the reason the therapeutic Michael Murphy's Human Potential Movement, Esalen Institute, and those kind of therapies took over society is that LaRouche is more conceptual approach to it. And television has weakened that left hemisphere, semi-left hemisphere agenda. And so when people are inside the Hieronymus Bosch effect of the pain of a new technology coming in, they feel like they're in a basic problem with their feeling states and need to express the anxiety of the new feelings they're getting from the new medium, and they can't process it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the anti-QB method took over. And dominate, and that's what Bruce spent 20 years critiquing. that, a therapy group approach. But he's trying to say in the last paragraph how you can deal with solving the monad problem by another route, which Kuby seems to have a clue in. He says, when the same self-analysis is affected in the case of individuals in a state of self-conscious creative production. See, there's his answer. When you do the same therapy group, but don't focus on expressing your feeling states or tapping into the id and saying that's your basic self, if you move into self-conscious creative production, that's a definition of LaRouche's formula.
I think he's saying it's ridiculous to try to wrestle with the id, but if you move into self-conscious creative production, you may transmute id energies into something useful.
Yeah, he says you may not even transmute it. You transmute or you get away from that, and the phenomena of the monad are not obtained. In that sentence, he's the previous paragraph and that whole monadic therapeutic group effect, he's not for.
Yeah, that's moving back into the
primitive.
Primitive and the child.
Yeah, and sensuously needing.
Yeah.
Needy.
Yeah.
Needy.
Yeah.
So it's self-conscious, self-aware creative production. And I don't, just carefully, I have to say self-aware, you get into aware, and then you get into touchy-feely thinking. So self-conscious.
Self-actualization. I wonder how he would feel about Maslow.
I don't know. He might, since that's the foundation of the Andy Kuby approach, he might not like where it led. But let's just complete the LaRouche thought. Now we know basically what he's saying. When the same self-analysis is affected in the case of individuals in a state of self-conscious creative production, the phenomena of the monad are not obtained. He's going, yay! The ego ideal and the notion of inner self are instead united in a single quality. In other words, you don't have an inner or an outer dialectic. You are one single entity.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The ideal and the self-doing it are united. Examined more superficially, one could obtain the apparent result emphasized by Kuby. So if you examine this superficially, you could obtain the apparent result emphasized by Kuby. And he's sort of saying this is okay. At first inspection, the idea of creative activity for its own sake is the ego ideal. And you got to mix that with the inner self. A form whose content is the activity of negentropic synthesis itself. Negentropic synthesis would be another way of having a union, a united single quality. Accordingly, if one studied artistic and other personalities who are merely creative or only yet potentially self-conscious, one would tend to concur with Kuby's argument that the creative process must be regarded as a virtue of self. He's saying that Kuby is dealing with just the beginning of the self-conscious creative production, not the full program that LaRouche is going to lay out. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Examine more superficially, one could obtain the apparent result emphasized by Kuby. In other words, it looks like Kuby's is pretty good, but he's only getting the beginning, dealing with people who are just beginning to be self-conscious creative producers, right? Because at first inspection, the idea of creative activity for its own sake is the ego ideal. In other words, Kuby says creative activity is where it's at. LaRouche is interested in the products that come out of it and the evolution of those products. So it's not creativity or art for its own sake.
But LaRouche is more than being interested in, he's interested in the products that come out of it. And I don't think he's interested in creativity for creativity's sake, but
yes.
I think he is interested in what are the means to becoming creative.
Right, and Kuby gets on the initial impetus and has it right, but gets bogged down in idealizing, making the ego ideal, creative activity itself.
Right, so I think I could sum it up in the phrase, how does one learn how to work?
Right. And what work do you apply yourself to?
Yeah.
LaRouche is not critical of people having time to think. He doesn't want them working day in, day out.
Yeah, work is, not trying to compare Gurdjieff. I'm just saying that Gurdjieff, he didn't call it meditation or spiritual development. He called his, what He called what he demanded from his students or disciples a discipline, and he called it the work. He said, you've got to learn how to work on behalf of creation. You have to learn how to do the great work. And I don't care how you feel. I don't care what you think. I don't care about your puny little body obsessions. What I care about is, are you going to learn to work? And this, and I have a method, and I'm going to show you how to work, which is how to be. It's the process of becoming creative.
Right. Now hold it. I would say that Gurdjieff would say that's similar to Kubi. They're emphasizing an aspect of the full program, and making too much out of it, because Gurdjieff gets you cleaning toilets and digging the ground. You're not producing any products, because he's siding towards developing the soul.
Yeah.
And that's where LaRouche won't go. LaRouche's second nature is where it's at.
Yeah. But LaRouche is saying the same thing. You got to learn how to work. I'll show you how to work, but the result of your effort, the fruit of your effort, is going to be different.
Yes. It's going to emphasize second nature development.
Yeah.
Feeding the world better energy and allowing us to have more time to work harder in thinking and creativity, so that we can make more technology to keep that high standards.
Right.
Technology's culture. Whereas, you know, Gurdjieff and New Age, they go of knowing the soul. So we got this doubleness of what's the big meaning. We can look at the soul as the big picture. What's the point of life? Why do I even exist? And how do I relate to that? And then the particulars are dealing with food and energy and shelter for the body.
Mm-hmm.
So we're juggling the big picture, the soul, with the immediate, the technology and the culture,
mm-hmm.
which can be, you know, growing food in primitive societies up to now, going to the market and getting an ATM card and getting your money out and or getting the digital transfer so you can take home an automobile. So the big and the little. And so what happened with the printed effect, to bring in McLuhan, is it made us enlarge the focus on the particular practical matters, not the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
The big picture was what McLuhan called the unified culture of the feudal ages, the primitive ages, the non-fragmented societies.
Mm-hmm.
The Tibetan culture kept the big picture in view, focused everything on that.
Here's a question I've been wanting to ask you about LaRouche, which will be interesting to me if LaRouche has ever commented, and I'll bet he has. What does LaRouche think of Ayn Rand? Because she is the quintessent production, industrial man, you know, that's her whole gig.
Right. I don't know. I'm pretty sure he's not impressed with her. I think that he would say that is maybe this first level of Kubi, getting into celebrating the individual's creative work to the max, intensifying the individual's input.
Right. She raises the guy who becomes the giant in terms
Prometheus.
Of she worships these guys, these industrialists, as being like Prometheus.
Now LaRouche, his high level of development is Prometheus. That's why I have Prometheus on the chart in the Dobbs quadrant. Prometheus is the advanced individual, but it's not to satisfy the individual's ego ideal of realizing themselves. LaRouche says put it back into the larger society.
Yeah.
So LaRouche is taking the particular details of daily pragmatic production and making that the big picture. So you get an argument over where are you going to place the big picture. He would disagree with me putting the big picture in the soul level.
Mm-hmm. Disagree with you?
Well, the way I laid it out 5 minutes ago, that Tibetan culture puts the big pictures of the soul as the big picture emphasis.
Right.
But so with all that in mind, we're really getting a good breakdown and understanding of LaRouche here, I think, and going through this. At least what the parameters of this one-page big quote is. At first inspection, the idea of creative activity for its own sake is the ego ideal. Yeah, that's Ayn Rand. The ego ideal is being creative, a form whose content is the activity of negentropic synthesis itself. It's like making the production process itself too much of a deal, forgetting the larger output. Accordingly, if one studied artistic and other personalities who are merely creative, see, this is who are merely creative. LaRouche is not putting a lot into, not putting everything, all his chips on just being creative. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Or only yet potentially self-conscious. They're just merely that. If one studied personalities who are merely creative, then one would tend to agree, concur with Kuby's argument that the creative process must be regarded as a virtue in itself. Now, that's not what we're about here in LaRouche land. And I'm beginning, remember, I haven't read these quotes in a long time, but I remember the context. I'm laying out the problem here, and we're now going to have quotes coming up about what is it that LaRouche is promoting that is not just promoting the creative process or being a genius in the cliche terms of it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what we're, this argument that's being built here.
Right.
There's many quotes here where he's trying to express what he said in the previous quote. Then what is the act corresponding to the pure emotion of love? What but the intensely sensuous, concretized celebration of creative sociality in general? He's emphasizing the beyond the self here,
mm-hmm.
The group. The mood must seize upon a concrete individual as his object. You focus on one person. It's a normal love relationship. Focus the effect of the big ocean. Either a concrete univir. Okay, you focus upon a concrete individual as his object, and that can be either a concrete universalizing social creative act. See, social creative, not just a particular individual creative act, as a great work of art, or you can focus on sensuous loving of a concrete universal person.
Mm-hmm.
So you're either, if you're using, he may be talking about an ideal here. Who's your role model?
Yeah, I've heard some, you know, artists who, you know, seem to feel like they've achieved the pinnacle of the creative process, say, once I'm done with the painting, I don't care about it anymore. You know, my manager takes it, it goes out into the world, somebody buys it, I don't ever want to see it again, it's a corpse.
Right.
It's the after image of the creative process. What was important to me was the impulse and the act of creating it, and once it's done, it's for me, it's dead.
I think that's the QB process LaRouche is critiquing.
Yeah.
In other words, why make it? He's going to make another painting, but he ain't producing a new software program or a new form of energy.
Right.
And that could be a product. That's a product of the individual created by the Gutenberg galaxy, a subjective individual psyche that must be energized.
Yeah.
And when Warhol and the post-World War II comes in electric age where the individual is so weakened, then you have art becoming a collective imagery and the idea of the genius becomes questioned. The whole industrial individual person doing its creative individual psyche work is a question from Dada or Duchamp, but then retrieved by the artist after the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the theme was art is dead, you know, the individual version of art. Because the collective art was taken over, and that was the Beatles and the Rolling Stones.
Right.
And Zappa was an anti-environment, in a way, retrieving the old LaRouche model. Now we get slightly into answering this question about how Zappa realizes, Zappa being a representative of the old 19th century individual genius, realizing the LaRouche model, if we want to limit LaRouche to that interpretation. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So we're now, we brought up that question last time or the previous time. And I said it'd take a while to work that out, but that's where this comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Zappa is realizing LaRouche is, from McLuhan's point of view, obsolete goals.
Yeah.
Have too much emphasis on the creative activity and its puny little software products. Whereas LaRouche is saying, back to that quote from last week, the last session, the mood must seize, this pure emotion of love must seize upon a concrete individual as its object. It seems to need a role model. That role model is either a universalizing social creative act as a great work of art, or a sensuous loving of a concrete universal person. In other words, the loving of maybe a Gandhi, or a great person who had represented universal qualities, or a work of art that represents universal.
Or possibly just your husband or wife.
Right, and that's, he could have meant that, but he's bringing in this stuff. Does one love your wife as a great work of art? Yes, some people are articulate or flamboyant enough to say that, but you see how it's not just limited to the one-on-one marriage relationship or love relationship
right here.
He's bringing in these universal social points, right? He has them in brackets.
Right.
This is at the bottom of page 8. But now, he writes a lot in that chapter. I mean, what I'm quoting here are fragments. and you'd have to read the whole paper that we can't fill in here, because I want to include all of LaRouche's work, not just the work of one phase. Yeah. But I do juxtapose the quote after what I just read, the quote we did this week, as a way of trying to point out the larger meanings and questions LaRouche is raising in relation to our assumptions of what creativity is.
Well, as Zappa would say, I think you're getting to the crux of the biscuit.
Yeah. Because the next quote will be, let's just read it to tease ahead. What is thought? Yeah, we dealt with what is love. What was it? What is the act corresponding to the pure emotion of love? So what is thought? Now, that's what I kept asking you through this session. How much time do we have left? 5 minutes?
I think we're about done. I've got a little, actually.
Okay, let me just say this. To end with this point, since we were describing, trying to figure out whether the images of love, of thought, he says, what is thought? It is the judgment which is regulated by the increase or decrease of the sense of identity. What is thought? It is the judgment which is regulated by the increase or decrease of the sense of identity. One acts not merely to attain fixed objects, fixed sensuous acts, but to attain those objects, actualize those thought acts which mediate and increase sense of identity. See? You see, you can see he's getting to, not getting to particular end results. There's an ongoing process going on here.
Mm-hmm.
In the pathological state, the force of judgment is regulated by an internalized babble of images, dominated usually by the mother image. With small effort, one can bring up the mother image, either reinforcing or reducing the sense of identity as an immediate regulator of sincerity of feeling in the adult. It is the same in politics. So it's going to get into other complexities, but what is thought? It is the judgment which is regulated by the increase or decrease.